Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Audiobook Break with Audiophile Magazine. I'm your host, Joe Reed. And it is the final chapter of Bram Stoker's Dracula, read by Gilder Jackson and published by Dreamscape. Now let's conclude this vampiric journey.
Chapter 27, which is the final chapter. Mina Harker's Journal. The 1st of November. All day long we have travelled, and at good speed. The horses seem to know that they are being treated kindly, for they go willingly their full stage at best speed. We have now had so many changes and find the same thing so constantly that we are encouraged to think that the journey will be an easy one. The 2nd of November, night. All day long driving. The country gets wilder as we go, and the great spurs of the Carpathians, which at Veresti seemed so far from us and so low on the horizon, now seem to gather round us and tower in front. Dr. Van Helsing says that by morning we shall reach the Borgo Pass. Memorandum by Abraham Van Helsing. The 5th of November, morning. Let me be accurate in everything that has happened since we came up on the Borgo Pass, for though you and I have seen some strange things together, you may at the first think that I, Van Helsing, am mad. That the many horrors and the so long strain on nerves has at the last turn my brain. Last night it was as though my memories of all Jonathan's horrid experience were befooling me, for the snowflakes and the mist began to wheel and circle round, till I could get as though a shadowy glimpse of those women that would have kissed him just outside the roaring light of the fire. And then the horses cowered lower and lower and moaned in terror as men do in pain. Even the madness of fright was not to them so that they could break away. I feared for my dear Madame Mina when these weird figures drew near and circled round. I looked at her, but she sat calm and smiled at me. When I would have stepped to the fire to replenish it, she caught me and held me back and whispered, like a voice that one hears in a dream, so low it was, "No, no, do not go without. Here you are safe." I turned to her and, looking in her eyes, said, "But you, it is for you that I fear." Whereat she laughed, a laugh low and unreal, and said, "Fear for me? Why fear for me? None safer in all the world from them than I am." And as I wondered at the meaning of her words, a puff of wind made the flame leap up, and I sees a red scar on her forehead. Then, alas, I knew. Did I not, I would soon have learned, for the wheeling figures of mist and snow came closer, but keeping ever without the holy circle. Then they began to materialize, till, if God have not taken away my reason, for I saw it through my eyes, there were before me in actual flesh the same three women that Jonathan saw in the room when they would have kissed his throat. I knew the swaying round forms, the bright, hard eyes, the white teeth, the ruddy colours, the voluptuous lips. They smiled ever at poor dear Madame Mina, and as their laugh came through the silence of the night, they twined their arms and pointed to her and said, in those so sweet, tingling tones that Jonathan said were of the intolerable sweetness of the water glasses, "Come, sister, come to us, come, come." In fear, I turned to my poor Madame Mina, and my heart with gladness leapt like flame. For oh, the terror in her sweet eyes, the repulsion, the horror, told a story to my heart that was all of hope. God be thanked, she was not yet of them. I seized some of the firewood which was by me, and holding out some of the wafer, advanced on them towards the fire. They drew back before me and laughed their low, horrid laugh. I fed the fire and feared them not, for I knew that we were safe within our protections. They could not approach me whilst so armed, nor Madame Mina while she remained within the holy ring I had created, which she could not leave, no more than they could enter. The horses ceased to moan and lay still on the ground. The snow fell on them softly, and they grew whiter. I knew that there was for the poor beasts no more terror. And so we remained till the red of the dawn to fall through the snow gloom. I was desolate and afraid and full of woe and terror, but when that beautiful sun began to climb, the horizon life was to me again. At the first coming of the dawn, the horrid figures melted in the whirling mist and snow. The wreaths of transparent gloom moved away towards the castle and were lost. Instinctively, with the dawn coming, I turned to Madame Mina, intending to hypnotize her, but she lay in a deep and sudden sleep from which I could not wake her. I tried to hypnotize through her sleep, but she made no response, none at all. And the day broke. I fear yet to stir. I have made my fire and have seen the horses. They are all dead. Today I have much to do here, and I keep waiting till the sun is up high, for there may be places where I must go, where that sunlight, though snow and mist obscure it, will be to me a safety. I will strengthen me with breakfast, and then I will to my terrible work. Madame Mina still sleeps, and God be thanked, she is calm in her sleep. Jonathan Harker's Journal. The 4th of November, evening. The accident to the launch has been a terrible thing for us. Only for it we should have overtaken the boat long ago, and by now my dear Mina would have been free. I fear to think of her off on the worlds near that horrid place. We have got horses and we follow on the track. I note this whilst Godalming is getting ready. We have our arms. The Sagani must look out if they mean to fight. Oh, if only Morris and Seward were with us. We must only hope. If I write no more, goodbye, Mina. God bless and keep you. Dr. Seward's Diary, the 5th of November. with the dawn, we saw the body of Sagani before us, dashing away from the river with their Leiterwagen. They surrounded it in a cluster and hurried along as though beset. The snow is falling lightly, and there is a strange excitement in the air. It may be our own feelings, but the depression is strange. Far off I hear the howling of wolves. The snow brings them down from the mountains, and there are dangers to all of us, and from all sides. The horses are nearly ready, and we are soon off. We ride to death of someone. God alone knows who, or where, or what, or when, or how it may be. Dr. Van Helsing's memorandum. The 5th of November, afternoon. I am at least sane. Thank God for that mercy, at all events, though the proving it has been dreadful. When I left Madame Mina sleeping within the Holy Circle, I took my way to the castle. The blacksmith hammer which I took in the carriage from Veresti was useful. Though the doors were all open, I broke them off the rusty hinges, lest some ill intent or ill chance should close them, so that being entered I might not get out. Jonathan's bitter experience served me here. By memory of his diary I found my way to the old chapel, for I knew that here my work lay. The air was oppressive. It seemed as if there was some sulphurous fume which at times made me dizzy. Either there was a roaring in my ears, or I heard afar off the howl of wolves. Then I besought me of my dear Madame Mina, and I was in terrible plight. The dilemma had me between his horns. Her I had not dare to take into this place, but left safe from the vampire in that holy circle. And yet even there would be the wolf. I resolved me that my work lay here, and that as to the wolves we must submit if it were God's will. At any rate it was only death and freedom beyond. So did I choose for her. Had it but been for myself, the choice had been easy. The maw of the wolf were better to rest in than the grave of the vampire. So, I make my choice to go on with my work. I knew that there were at least three graves to find, graves that are in habit. So I search, and I find one of them. She lay in her vampire sleep, so full of life and voluptuous beauty that I shudder as though I have come to do murder. Ah, I doubt not that in old time, when such things were, many a man who set forth to do such a task as mine found at the last his heart fail him, and then his nerve. So he delay, till the mere beauty and the fascination of the wanton undead have hypnotized him, and he remain on and on till sunset come, and the vampire sleep be over. Then the beautiful eyes of the fair woman open and look love, and the voluptuous mouth present to a kiss, and man is weak. And there remain one more victim in the vampire fold, one more to swell the grim and grisly ranks of the undead. There is some fascination, surely, when I am moved by the mere presence of such an one, even lying as she lay in a tomb, fretted with age and heavy with the dust of centuries, though there be that horrid odour such as the lairs of the Count have had. Yes, I was moved. I, Van Helsing, with all my purpose and with my motive for hate, I was moved to a yearning for delay. which seemed to paralyze my faculties and to clog my very soul. It may have been that the need of natural sleep and the strange oppression of the air were beginning to overcome me. Certain it was that I was lapsing into sleep, the open-eyed sleep of one who yields to a sweet fascination, when there came through the snow-stilled air a long, low wail, so full of woe and pity that it woke me like the sound of a clarion. For it was the voice of my dear Madame Mina that I heard. Then I braced myself again to my horrid task and found, by wrenching away tomb tops, one other of the sisters, the other dark one. I dared not pause to look on her as I had on her sister, lest once more I should begin to be in thrall. But I go on searching until presently I find in a high, great tomb, as if made to one much beloved, that other fair sister, which, like Jonathan, I had seen to gather herself out of the atoms of the mist. She was so fair to look on, so radiantly beautiful, so exquisitely voluptuous, that the very instinct of man in me, which calls some of my sex to love and to protect one of hers, made my head whirl with new emotion. But God be thanked, that soul wail of my dear Madame Mina had not died out of my ears. And before the spell could be wrought further upon me, I had nerved myself to my wild work. By this time, I had searched all the tombs in the chapel, so far as I could tell. And as there had been only three of these undead phantoms around us in the night, I took it that there were no more of active undead existent. There was one great tomb, more lordly than all the rest. Huge it was, and nobly proportioned. On it, but one word. Dracula. This, then, was the undead home of the king vampire, to whom so many more were due. Its emptiness spoke eloquent to make certain what I knew. Before I began to restore these women to their dead selves through my awful work, I laid in Dracula's tomb some of the wafer, and so banished him from it, undead, forever. Then began my terrible task, and I dreaded it. Had it been but one, it had been easy comparative. But three. To begin twice more, after I had been through a deed of horror, for if it was terrible with the sweet Lucy, what would it not be with these strange ones who had survived through centuries and who had been strengthened by the passing of the years, who would, if they could, have fought for their foul lives? Before I left the castle, I so fixed its entrances that never more can the Count enter there undead. When I stepped into the circle where Madame Mina slept, she woke from her sleep and, seeing me, cried out in pain that I had endured too much.
"Come," she said, "come away from this awful place. Let us go to meet my husband, who is, I know, coming towards us."
She was looking thin and pale and weak, but her eyes were pure and glowed with fervour. I was glad to see her paleness and her illness, for my mind was full of the fresh horror of that ruddy vampire sleep. And so, with trust and hope, and yet full of fear, we go eastward to meet our friends, and him, whom Madame Mina tell me that she know are coming to meet us. Mina Harker's Journal, the 6th of November. It was late in the afternoon when the professor and I took our way towards the east, whence I knew Jonathan was coming. We did not go fast, though the way was steeply downhill, for we had to take heavy rugs and wraps with us. We dared not face the possibility of being left without warmth in the cold and the snow. We had to take some of our provisions, too, for we were in a perfect desolation, and so far as we could see through the snowfall, there was not even the sign of habitation. When we had gone about a mile, I was tired with the heavy walking and sat down to rest. Then we looked back and saw where the clear line of Dracula's castle cut the sky. For we were so deep under the hill whereon it was set that the angle of perspective of the Carpathian Mountains was far below it. We saw it in all its grandeur, perched 1,000 feet on the summit of a sheer precipice, and with seemingly a great gap between it and the steep of the adjacent mountain on any side. There was something wild and uncanny about the place. We could hear the distant howling of wolves. They were far off, but the sound, even though coming muffled through the deadening snowfall, was full of terror. I knew from the way Dr. Van Helsing was searching about that he was trying to seek some strategic point where we would be less exposed in case of attack. The rough roadway still led downwards. We could trace it through the drifted snow. In a little while, the professor signaled to me, so I got up and joined him. He had found a wonderful spot, a sort of natural hollow in a rock, with an entrance like a doorway between two boulders. He took me by the hand and drew me in. "See," he said, "here you will be in shelter, and if the wolves do come, I can meet them one by one." He brought in our furs and made a snug nest for me, and got out some provisions and forced them upon me. But I could not eat. To even try to do so was repulsive to me, and much as I would have liked to please him, I could not bring myself to the attempt. He looked very sad, but did not reproach me. Taking his field glasses from the case, he stood on the top of the rock and began to search the horizon. Suddenly, he called out, "Look! Madame Mina, look! Look!" I sprang up and stood beside him on the rock. He handed me his glasses and pointed. The snow was now falling more heavily and swirled about fiercely, for a high wind was beginning to blow. However, there were times when there were pauses between the snow flurries, and I could see a long way round. From the height where we were, it was possible to see a great distance. And far off, beyond the white waste of snow, I could see the river lying like a black ribbon in kinks and curls as it wound its way. Straight in front of us, and not far off, in fact so near that I wondered we had not noticed before, came a group of mounted men hurrying along. In the midst of them was a cart, a long Leiterwagen, which swept from side to side, like a dog's tail wagging, with each stern inequality of the road. Outlined against the snow as they were, I could see from the men's clothes that they were peasants or gypsies of some kind. On the cart was a great square chest. My heart leaped as I saw it, for I felt that the end was coming. The evening was now drawing close, and well I knew that at sunset the thing which was till then imprisoned there, would take new freedom, and could, in any of many forms, elude all pursuit. In fear I turned to the professor. To my consternation, however, he was not there. An instant later, I saw him below me. Round the rock he had drawn a circle, such as we had found shelter in last night. When he had completed it, he stood beside me again, saying, "At least you shall be safe here from him." He took the glasses from me, and at the next lull in the snow, swept the whole space before us. "See," he said, "they come quickly. They are flogging the horses and galloping as hard as they can." He paused and went on in a hollow voice. "They are racing for the sunset. We may be too late. God's will be done." Down came another blinding rush of driving snow, and the whole landscape was blotted out. It soon passed, however, and once more his glasses were fixed on the plain. Then came a sudden cry. "Look, look, look! See! Two horsemen follow fast, coming up from the south. It must be Quincy and John. Take the glass. Look before the snow blots it all out." I took it and looked. The two men might be Dr. Seward and Mr. Morris. I knew at all events that neither of them was Jonathan. At the same time, I knew that Jonathan was not far off. Looking around, I saw on the north side of the party coming two other men, riding at breakneck speed. One of them I knew was Jonathan, and the other I took, of course, to be Lord Godalming. They, too, were pursuing the party with the cart. When I told the professor, he shouted in glee like a schoolboy, and after looking intently till a snowfall made sight impossible, he laid his Winchester rifle ready for use against the boulder at the opening of our shelter. "They are all converging," he said. "When the time comes, we shall have gypsies on all sides." I got out my revolver, ready to hand, for whilst we were speaking, the howling of wolves came louder and closer. When the snowstorm abated a moment, we looked again. It was strange to see the snow falling in such heavy flakes close to us, and beyond, the sun shining more and more brightly as it sank down toward the far mountain tops. Sweeping the glass all around us, I could see here and there dots moving singly and in twos and threes and large numbers. The wolves were gathering for their prey. Closer and closer they drew. The professor and I crouched down behind our rock and held our weapons ready. I could see that he was determined that they should not pass. One and all were quite unaware of our presence. All at once, two voices shouted out to "Halt!" One was my Jonathan's, raised in a high key of passion. The other, Mr. Morris's strong, resolute tone of quiet command. The gypsies may not have known the language, but there was no mistaking the tone in whatever tongue the words were spoken. Instinctively, they reined in, and at the instant Lord Godalming and Jonathan dashed up at one side, and Dr. Seward and Mr. Morris on the other. The leader of the gypsies, a splendid-looking fellow who sat his horse like a centaur, waved them back, and in a fierce voice gave to his companions some word to proceed. They lashed the horses, which sprang forward, but the four men raised their Winchester rifles and in an unmistakable way commanded them to stop. And at the same time, Dr. Van Helsing and I rose behind the rock and pointed our weapons at them. Seeing that they were surrounded, the men tightened their reins and drew up. The leader turned to them and gave a word at which every man of the gypsy party drew what weapon he carried, knife or pistol, and held himself in readiness to attack. Issue was joined in an instant. The leader, with a quick movement of his rein, threw his horse out in front and pointing first to the sun, now close down on the hilltops, and then to the castle, said something which I did not understand. For answer, all four men of our party threw themselves from their horses and dashed towards the cart. I should have felt terrible fear at seeing Jonathan in such danger, but that the ardour of battle must have been upon me as well as the rest of them. I felt no fear, but only a wild, surging desire to do something. Seeing the quick movement of our parties, the leader of the gypsies gave a command. His men instantly formed round the cart in a sort of undisciplined endeavour, each one shouldering and pushing the other in his eagerness to carry out the order. In the midst of this, I could see that Jonathan on one side of the ring of the men and Quincy on the other were forcing away to the cart. It was evident that they were bent on finishing their task before the sun should set. Nothing seemed to stop or even hinder them. Neither the levelled weapons, nor the flashing knives of the gypsies in front, nor the howling of the wolves behind appeared to even attract their attention. Jonathan's impetuosity and the manifest singleness of his purpose seemed to overawe those in front of him. Instinctively they cowered aside and let him pass. In an instant he had jumped upon the cart and with a strength which seemed incredible, raised the great box and flung it over the wheel to the ground. In the meantime, Mr. Morris had had to use force to pass through his side of the ring of Sagani. All the time I had been breathlessly watching Jonathan, I had, with the tail of my eye, seen him pressing desperately forward and had seen the knives of the gypsies flash as he won a way through them, and they cut at him. He had parried with his great bowie knife, and at first I thought that he too had come through in safety. But as he sprang beside Jonathan, who had by now jumped from the cart, I could see that with his left hand he was clutching at his side, and that the blood was spurting through his fingers. He did not delay, notwithstanding this, for as Jonathan with desperate energy attacked one end of the chest, attempting to prise off the lid with his great kukri knife, he attacked the other frantically with his bowie. Under the efforts of both men, the lid began to yield, the nails drew with a quick screeching sound, and the top of the box was thrown back. By the time the gypsies, seeing themselves covered by the Winchesters and at the mercy of Lord Godalming and Dr. Seward, had given in and made no resistance. The sun was almost down on the mountain tops, and the shadows of the whole group fell long upon the snow. I saw the Count lying within the box upon the earth, some of which the rood falling from the cart had scattered over him. He was deathly pale, just like a waxen image, and the red eyes glared with the horrible vindictive look which I knew too well. As I looked, the eyes saw the sinking sun, and the look of hate in them turned to triumph. But on the instant came the sweep and flash of Jonathan's great knife. I shrieked as I saw it shear through the throat, whilst at the same moment Mr. Morris's bowie knife plunged into the heart. It was like a miracle, but before our very eyes, and almost in the drawing of a breath, the whole body crumbled into dust and passed from our sight. I shall be glad, as long as I live, that even in that moment of final dissolution, there was in the face a look of peace, such as I never could have imagined might have rested there. The castle of Dracula now stood out against the red sky, and every stone of its broken battlements was articulated against the light of the setting sun. The gypsies, taking us as in some way the cause of the extraordinary disappearance of the dead man, turned without a word and rode away as if for their lives. Those who were unmounted jumped upon the lighter wagon and shouted to the horsemen not to desert them. The wolves, which had withdrawn to a safe distance, followed in their wake, leaving us alone. Mr. Morris, who had sunk to the ground, leaned on his elbow, holding his hand pressed to his side. The blood still gushed through his fingers. I flew to him, for the Holy Circle did not now keep me back. So did the two doctors. Jonathan knelt beside him, and the wounded man laid back his head on his shoulder. With a sigh, he took, with a feeble effort, my hand in that of his own, which was unstained. He must have seen the anguish of my heart in my face, for he smiled at me and said,
I am only too happy to have been of any service. Oh, God!
He cried, suddenly struggling up to a sitting posture and pointing to me.
It was worth for this to die. Look! Look!
The sun was now right down upon the mountain top, and the red gleams fell upon my face so that it was bathed in rosy light. With one impulse, the men sank on their knees, and a deep and earnest Amen broke from all as their eyes followed the pointing of his finger. The dying man spoke.
Now God be thanked that all has not been in vain. See, the snow is not more stainless than her forehead. The curse has passed away.
And to our bitter grief, with a smile, and in silence, he died. A gallant gentleman. The end.
Thank you all so much for joining me for this fireside reading of this wonderful book, Dracula, by Bram Stoker. I do hope that you've enjoyed watching and listening as much as I have enjoyed reading it to you. Please join us for another fireside reading of another wonderful old book whenever you can. But until then, everyone, I do hope you stay very, very well. Good night.
This is the end of today's audiobook break and the end of our time with Count Dracula. Thank you for joining us this season as we listen to Bram Stoker's Dracula, read by Gildert Jackson, published by Dreamscape. We'll be back in 2023 with more audiobooks for you to enjoy on Audiobook Break from Audiophile Magazine. I'm Joe Reed. Thanks for listening.